United States against Trice. Mr. Brandt.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Jeff Brandt on behalf of Wilfred Trice. His arguments today in part submit that despite twice referring to 18 U.S.C. 3553A, that the district court in this case largely ignored Booker, treated the guidelines as a presumptive or as a super sentencing factor, and just like before, Booker established a guideline range, considered that presumptive, and then threw it to the attorneys to convince the district court to come off of that range, obviously for the defense to come down and for the prosecution to come up. His first argument is that if the district court treats the guidelines as presumptive, it cannot constitutionally then create the guideline range based upon judicial fact-finding. And then somewhat in an inverse, he argues that if the district court may set the guideline range based upon a preponderance, as McReynolds has stated, then it must also follow McReynolds and treat the guidelines as only one of many sentencing factors. We submit that the best evidence that the district court treated the guidelines as presumptive and a super sentencing factor is the transcript itself, which is attached in full to our opening brief in the appendix. The district court began and ended with the guidelines, and it begins in the first two pages talking about objections to the guidelines. It moves on the next page to discuss McReynolds, but again, we believe that McReynolds is correct as long as the guidelines are one of many factors. And then the court goes into relevant conduct, base offense level 38, 2D1.1C1, 2D1.1B1, and the guideline range. At that point, the district court turns the hearing over to the attorneys, saying, okay, here, we 235 to 293 months. Convince me it's otherwise. Defense counsel goes into several non-guideline factors. The prosecution sort of poo-poos the idea that high school dropout or a difficult childhood can have any bearing on the sentence in the federal system these days. And then the district court again references 3553 very briefly, talking about A2's purposes of sentencing, but then comes right back to the guidelines and imposes a sentence in the middle of the guideline range. We submit that the district court was required to apply the 3553 factors and that the sentence imposed demonstrates that the factors that existed here were rejected. The guidelines cannot substitute for all sentencing factors because the guidelines reject so many factors that 3553 encourages. Examples, socioeconomic status, 5H1.10 of the guidelines says don't consider it. Substance addiction, 5H1.4. Disadvantaged upbringing, 5H1.12. What did the district court hear in this case? The district court heard Mr. Trice never knew his father, never. Trice's mother was mentally ill and couldn't care for him. He was bounced from foster home to extended family member back to foster home. He ran away at the age of 11. He eventually lived with his uncle but dropped out of school after the ninth grade and had significant alcohol dependence. These are the socioeconomic dependence history and characteristics of the defendant that 3553 requires the district court to look at. But again, the government says, hey, you know, this was the third defendant, I believe, to be the second or third defendant in this case to be sentenced that day. And both the government's counsel and the district court saying, hey, we keep hearing this dropout issue, and then kind of set that aside like that's not important. And we submit that's an error. If the guidelines reject these factors, that means a sentence in the guideline range rejects these 3553 factors. We believe that there were several alternatives to a 22-year sentence in federal prison. We believe that's not rehabilitation, and that to pretend that 22 years of federal prison is rehabilitation is to ignore the phrase sufficient but not greater than necessary. Trice's kids, at least for 22 years, are going to be without their father like he was for a great period of time, and we might start the cycle all over again. And even if I'm wrong about what the district court did, and we believe we're not, we believe that the sentence was certainly more than necessary in light of all of those 3553 factors, and that the district court erred and gave a sentence that was greater than necessary, and that in the phraseology of this court and its review, unreasonable. We also note that if the district court pages, the government says in its brief pages 8 through 12 of the sentencing hearing that the judge was somehow looking at 3553. It only mentioned it once and didn't apply the law of 3553 to facts. If this court's job is to look for reasonableness, how can it look for reasonableness without a district court telling this court and others what those factors were and whether it rejected it?
Well, Mr. Brandt, didn't the district judge mention that these factors were outweighed? I mean, doesn't that suggest it was encompassed in his thinking?
I can see that, but doesn't that mean that like it's the guidelines on one side versus the rest? Not that it's guidelines one and A1 is one and A2 is one and A3 is one. If it's just a matter of balancing, I guess that means the judge rejected. I mean, maybe there's some weight to it, but doesn't that mean we pull down from the guidelines? If those facts are true but less weighty, okay. Well, then why are we getting a sentence in the middle of the guideline range, not the bottom or just below the guideline range? Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Mr. Peters.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Tom Peters for Jabbar Smith. With respect to Mr. Smith's case this morning, the issue is whether he's entitled to a remand for reconsideration of his sentence in light of the fact that the district court appears to have imposed a longer than necessary sentence, at least to some degree, based on the erroneous assumption that Mr. Smith had refused lawful employment. I don't understand the government's position to be that is not a mistake on the district court's part. I believe that they are conceding that there was a mistake made with respect to that observation or conclusion or fact-finding that the district court did. And the position of Mr. Smith, respectfully this morning, is that to some degree his sentence is greater than, for example, the minimum guideline range because the district court believed that he had refused lawful employment. The sentencing hearing here is very brief. The observations by the district court do include references to the 353 factors, but the only specific references in the district court's finding are to the fact that given Mr. Smith's prior criminal history, there was a recidivism concern, and that certainly is a legitimate concern. That to some degree is taken into account by the fact that he's already in criminal history category 3, but nonetheless, the court certainly has the right to take that into account. The only other specific reference, though, at the time of sentencing, which was very brief considering the fact that Mr. Smith ends up with 24 years in custody, is to the fact that there was, I believe the quote is, no coercion, no reason to refuse employment, or something very close to that. And with respect to that, the pre-sentence report indicates no such evidence. I mean, the evidence in to the extent the pre-sentence report is accurate, as I assume it is, the pre-sentence report says that Mr. Smith had been employed, albeit sporadically, with his father, a fact that was apparently confirmed with the father, and there's no evidence that he willfully refused lawful employment. And since the hearing itself is very abbreviated, and the only specific references are to the recidivism issue and to this refusal to accept employment, it seems to me that it is a reasonable inference for the court to conclude that, to some degree, this sentence was affected by that mistaken impression. And what I think the appropriate remedy should be is to remand the case to the district court to decide, for the district court to say, yes, I did consider that, and to this extent. Because to whatever extent the district court mistakenly considered it, whether it was for 10 months or 20 months or 1 month, the defendant's sentence is being adversely affected by that mistaken impression. So the appropriate remedy is to send the case back to the district court and ask the district court, or with instructions to the district court, to reconsider the sentence in light of the fact that there is no evidence that Mr. Smith refused an opportunity for lawful employment. And with that, we respectfully urge that the court grant that relief.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Mr. Yarosh.
Please, the court, counsel. Peter Jarosh for the United States, Your Honor. I'd first like to address Mr. Smith's argument concerning the remark by Judge Shabazz during the sentencing regarding a comment made in context and what it means. In that particular part of the sentencing transcript, Judge Shabazz is commenting upon the recidivism potential of this defendant, indicating that the risk is quite high. And in it, he makes the comment that there was no coercion or no requirement that the defendant refuse employment. That comes in the context of defendant's behavior during his state probationary period. On page 8 of our brief and in the PSR, it indicates that the defendant, in paragraph 118 of the PSR, the defendant admitted that he was in good health. In paragraph 121, he admitted that he had no mental health problem. And in paragraph 119 of the PSR, the defendant admitted lying about having some sort of brain injury that prevented him from working. The obvious implication is that indeed defendant had no metaphysical or some requirement or coercion stopping him from having employment. And when put into that context, the judge's, albeit comment, and not a factual finding, comment has a basis. The point here is not that this is a factual finding. And the reason, as the defense counsel are pointing out, that the hearing was so short, there were no objections. This wasn't a contested issue. There was no requirement for Judge Shabazz to make any sort of factual finding. Instead, it was a superfluous comment in light of his other comments about the defendant's chance of recidivism, which goes back to the factors that were considered in Smith's case, namely the amount of drugs involved, over 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine, the large amount of income produced, and the long duration of the conspiracy, over 2.5 years. These are factors that go to the defendant's circumstances and history, as well as the seriousness of the offense. And these are all legitimate 3553A factors that the court appropriately considered. There is no error here from the judge's comment, and there is certainly, even in the worst situation, that this is somehow a factual finding, indeed there isn't a basis for this finding, because the defendant, in fact, misstated his brain injury to the probation office. In terms of Mr. Tice, similarly, the court weighed the factors of 3553A, again, finding the large amount of drugs involved, the length of the conspiracy, the fact that the defendant had no real employment except for drug dealing, and that's how he supported his family. The court took into consideration the defendant's statements concerning the lack of a criminal history, that it was rather low, that he had a strong support of the community, and that he had a real lack of a stable upbringing. But the defendant himself, as the court recognized, said he had fond memories of his childhood, and he contradicted that sort of idea that somehow he was lacking it. So the court took that into consideration, the defendant's arguments, looked at the guidelines as one of many factors that the court considered, and said, good Lord, this thing really isn't outweighed, and the defendant's sentence in basically the middle of the guideline range is both reasonable and in no way error. Both the defendants in this case received sentences that were in the middle of the guideline range after the court considered correctly the mitigating and aggravating factors and just generally the factors of 3553A. This court should affirm this sentence as both reasonable and without error.
We have a case here with pretty significant sentences. I'm sure you would agree.
Absolutely.
And in the case of Mr. Trice and Mr. Smith, 4 years before the grand jury indicts, there's an arrest, is there not, with a substantial amount of cash? And
in January 2001, there was an arrest, correct?
Is there some reason why we have a four-year hiatus on action against these defendants when they had substantial amount of money, at least $20,000, and obviously a lesser amount of drugs? For what reason were they was justice sort of delayed here, if you will? I understand the role of the courts and that you're a member of the executive branch, but it you know, I'm just wondering if actions were taken when clearly arrests were made 4 years before the grand jury indictment, what we might have before us by way of sentences.
Well, Your Honor, and that would be true if the defendants didn't do anything else. And maybe that the court is saying is right. What we have here, though, is we have evidence of defendants coming in from Chicago to Wisconsin with lots and lots of drugs. And to determine the full scope and breadth of this conspiracy.
So the government decided to let them become drug peddlers for four more years?
Your Honor, it is done all the time. It's not
well,
a matter
I appreciate that. But the main thrust of this appeal is the severity of the sentences, and I'm not in any way suggesting that we had angelic actors for those 4 years. I'm just wondering where the Justice Department is on its action with an arrest 4 years before and with significant drugs.
I think, Your Honor, the purpose, if the court will allow me, the purpose of these drug cases is to determine the full scope and breadth of these conspiracies. Because otherwise, as the court is well aware, if you take off one individual or you take off two individuals, you never end up finding out truly where these people are and how big this organization is. And so when Wisconsin is faced with situations where people are coming up from Chicago, it is reasonable for the Department of Justice to try to get a handle around the full scope of this organization.
Well, in the case of Mr. Smith, he's sentenced at the age of 24. Is that right?
That's correct, sir.
So when his arrest is made, he's 19 years old, and the presumption is he's a major trafficker in 2001 that you want to trail for another 4 years?
Your Honor, the facts are what the facts are.
All right. It just strikes me as... In a temporal sense, a little longer than we usually confront, Mr. Jarosz.
I understand, Your Honor. If there are no further questions from the court,
thank you. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Brandt?
Briefly, Your Honor, government's counsel mentioned no objections means no findings of fact. Well, no objections means no findings of fact required as to the guidelines, not as to the remaining 3553 factors. Defense counsel in this case went on to list other facts, and there wasn't the same sort of analysis that had taken place when it came to the guidelines. When speaking of non-guideline issues, counsel mentions amount of drugs and criminal history. Those aren't non-guideline factors. Those are guideline factors. In the sense that these factors had less weight, I go back to the idea that if there was less weight and they were valid, a guideline sentence that fails to include these factors does not adequately sentence. And finally, what about kinds of sentences available? Probation, intense community service. That's a part of 3553. The district court also used as a factor wake-up call. This is going to be a wake-up call to the defendant. I don't see that in the guidelines. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Mr. Peters, anything further?
With respect to the issue of the statements in the pre-sentence report concerning, I believe Mr. Smith said at one point he had a brain injury. That had nothing to do with being offered lawful employment at that time, as I understand it. I think that he was giving a false excuse to the probation department about his failure to be employed. But I see that as qualitatively different from the statement that he had refused lawful employment.
Well, did he really say that? I understand, and I'm not ready to label it a throwaway line, Mr. Peters, but he said that no coercion, no requirement that he refuse employment. One could reasonably read, as you suggest, that therefore the judge is concluding there's something there to suggest that he had. On the other hand, other than a sporadic tie to the father, and I'm not suggesting there weren't days that he worked, it doesn't show much in the way of a work history. And so isn't he just commenting generally that he made his living as a drug dealer and not in a gainful, lawful way?
I think, Your Honor, given the words that were chosen at that time, that there is enough of a reason here to at least ask the court, which is what I'm recommending, is to say there's enough doubt here as to whether you considered a false or a mistaken assumption, that we should at least let you clear this up. And if, in fact, the district court judge says, well, it was just a slip of the tongue, or I was just commenting in the manner that you have suggested, then I suppose the same sentence would be imposed. On the other hand, if, in fact, it goes back and he says, well, you know what, I made an honest mistake, and I would not have given you this sentence had I realized that I had made this mistake, because after all, I did three other sentencing hearings that day, and maybe he's remembering a fact from some other defendant, then the sentence may be reduced. I'm not in favor of making additional work for district courts, but I think there's enough here to warrant that relief.
Is there any possibility that he would be at risk of an increased sentence before Judge Shabazz?
I don't believe so, because there's only that factor that I'm requesting that it be returned for, and I don't understand the government to be asking for anything else. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.